So I really love the book of Psalms. It's a book that's really kind of blown up for me in the last couple of years. Before then, the book of Psalms was always kind of like a lame book to me. I never really read it. But what I recognize that the book of Psalms is now is what the book of Psalms does for us is it shows us practically how to walk with God. And this is what I mean by that. And when you get into the New Testament, what you have is you have people telling you to do things. But they never really tell you practically what it's going to look like to do them. And so you're kind of lost. And let me give you an example. In the book of Philippians, chapter 4, Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in all things with prayer and supplication, make your requests be known to God, and the peace that passes understanding will guard your hearts." And you read that passage and you're like, oh, okay, so I'm just never going to be stressed out again, you know? I'm just going to pray, and then I'm never going to be stressed out again. That's what you think, that's what you think he means. But that's not how it practically looks. It's difficult. And then you have Psalms like Psalm 42, Psalm 88, where what you see is you see people struggling with depression and anxiety, and you see them practically pouring that out to the Lord, and you see how God answers them. So that's why the Psalms are so important. They're really a staple inside of a growing, maturing Christian's life. This is how you know how to walk with, communicate with, and grow in God. That's what the Psalms do. And Psalm 63 is an amazing psalm. It's very short, but the message in it is so incredible. It says, if you guys notice in the little heading, some of the psalms have headings in them, and they tell you who wrote them and why they wrote them. And this heading says this, "A Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah." Now, there was a lot of times where David was in the wilderness of Judah in his life because he started out his life as a shepherd. And then after he was a shepherd, he became a soldier. And then after he was a soldier, he became king. And so there's a lot of instances in his life where we could look at and be like, that may have been when he was writing this, but we don't know. But then in verse 11, it gives us a little bit of a better clue where David actually says that he is king at the moment that he's writing this. So that helps us narrow it down even more. So because of that, when was a time in David's life when he was king and yet he was stranded in the wilderness where people wanted to kill him? And there's really only one season in David's life that meets that criteria. And there's actually a lot of backstory to this. I don't have time to get into it in depth, but let me give the highlights. David was kind of a lustful, adulterous guy. That was one sin that he really wrestled with in his life. He was told by God in Deuteronomy 17 to only have one wife, and he didn't follow that. He had multiple wives. He had sex slaves on top of that. And the thing that we have to understand about our lust, the more you feed your lust, the more it demands. So he fed his lust, and he fed his lust, and he fed his lust, but it wasn't enough for him. And so he began to lust after a married woman. He had sex with her, and then he murdered her husband. After that, it finally came out, and God told David, as a consequence of what you have done, says, first of all, the son that you have conceived with this woman will die. Then, he says, the sword will never leave your house. Your sons will fight each other until the day you die and even after you die. And that's really the legacy of David, is the infighting that happens with his sons. If you keep reading in the life of Solomon, Solomon ends up having to kill his brothers because they want to kill him. And then Solomon's son is the one who ends up splitting Israel in half and causing an entire civil war. That is the legacy of David. That is the legacy of what he did, the kind of man he chose to be. And when we look at this story, what's going on here is we really see why practically this was a consequence of what David did. And here's what happened. David, because he had so many wives, he had a ton of kids. And he couldn't be a good father to all of them. And he had this one son who grew up looking at the way his dad treated women, and it impacted him. And he ended up lusting after his own sister. It was his half-sister, but it was his flesh and blood. He began to lust after her. It was a beautiful girl named Tamar. And he lusted after so much that one of his buddies says, you know what you should do? You should pretend to be sick, and then when she comes in to give you food, you should put the moves on her. And this guy was such a sicko that he took that to mean rape her. So he invited her to come in. She came in, and he did. He raped her. And as bad as that is, David's daughter Tamar also grew up in the same household, watching her dad, watching the way her dad treated women. And you know what that did to her? That made her start to believe that women don't have value. And so after she was raped, she looked at her molester and she said, "Please marry me. Because I'm damaged goods now. No one's going to want me. Please marry me." And he rejected her, and she went away, and she lived in just complete depression for the rest of her life. Her brother, her actual full brother, was a guy named Absalom. And Absalom was so enraged at what happened in this scenario. And he was even more enraged by the fact that David never disciplined his son that did that. That Absalom took justice in his own hands. He murdered that guy. And then David got mad at Absalom, exiled him. And so Absalom, the bitterness that Absalom had for David was increased even more. So when they finally reconciled years later, Absalom had formulated a plan to overtake the throne of David. And he put it into practice. He eventually was successful. He garnered enough support to throw his own father out of the kingdom and tried to hunt him down and kill him. So that is when David is writing this. That is what's going on in his life when he is writing this psalm. That's a pretty intense moment for him. And let's read what he writes. Verse 1, "O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness. And my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches, because you have been my help. Therefore, in the shadow of your wings, I will rejoice. My soul follows close behind you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him shall glory. But the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped." Now, it doesn't really sound like the kind of psalm that you would write in the particular circumstances that I just laid out for you guys, does it? And some important things I want to pull out about this psalm and the purpose of why David is writing it is this is what why he's writing it. David is describing something that happens in every person's life. And I'm going to call it this. It's spiritual thirst. That's what it is. That's what he's struggling with when he's writing this psalm. It's a spiritual type of thirst. And everybody, like I said, everybody struggles with this. And we just have different sources of how to fill ourselves. And this type of thirst can look like anything. It could look like depression. It could look like sorrow. It could look like grief. It could look like guilt. It could look like shame. It could look like regret. It could look like loneliness. It could look like stress. It could look like bitterness. There's so many different ways that this thirst can look. And there are so many different sources that we can go to fill this particular thirst. Now, it would be a Bible study in and of itself for me to explain this, but I'm just going to touch on it because that's not the purpose of this psalm. But Jesus, in John chapter 4 and in John chapter 7, he declares that he is the thing that your soul is actually thirsting for. In John chapter 7, he says, "Anyone who thirsts, anyone who has any of those problems that I just mentioned to you guys," Jesus says, "come to me and drink, and out of you will flow rivers of living water." He's saying, "I'm going to satisfy you. I am what your soul is thirsting for. I am a pleasure. I am a satisfaction that you have never experienced. I will put to death your bitterness. I will give you hope in your depression. I will give you freedom from guilt and shame." Everything that I just mentioned, Jesus says, "I will set you free from it by believing in me." That's what Jesus says he is. And like I said, that's a sermon in itself, and I don't have time to go into it, because that is not what this psalm is about. This psalm is not about someone who doesn't understand that Jesus is their ultimate satisfaction and pleasure. If you don't understand that, which I didn't for years, I used to think of God as like a withholding God. I thought of God as a God that I had to serve and that I had to live up to his standards. I never thought of God as a giving, pleasurable God. So if you don't see Jesus that way, your perspective does need to change. However, like I said, that's not David's problem. See, David's problem is actually a little bit deeper than that. David's problem is that he knows that Jesus is the satisfaction for his soul. And he's pursuing Jesus as if he is the satisfaction for his soul, but he's not getting it. Let me repeat to you verse 1. O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. You guys get that? He's saying, I'm thirsting for you. I'm looking for you. I'm seeking you. But it's like looking for water in a place where there is no water. To put it in another way, he says, I'm looking for God, but God feels distant. He feels removed. He feels uninterested with what's going on in my life. And he feels like he's not listening. Now that is a much deeper problem than not understanding that Jesus is your ultimate satisfaction. See, not understanding that Jesus is your ultimate satisfaction, all you need to know is that he is. And you're like, oh, okay, that solves the problem. But knowing the solution, but being unable to attain it, is a much worse problem. And this is the type of spiritual thirst that happens to every Christian. And we need to be ready for it. We need to understand this will happen. If you think that just understanding that Jesus is my everything is going to solve all your problems, then you're thinking much too simplistically. This will happen to everyone. Every single one of us will go through a season where we are anxiously pursuing God and we're receiving nothing. Where we are anxiously pursuing God, but we are receiving absolutely no comfort. Where there is no evidence that God is even there. You will go through times where you're praying and you won't feel like he's listening. You'll feel like an idiot. You feel like you're talking to yourself. You will be reading the Bible and you will get nothing out of it. You will go to church and you will feel lonely. You will feel like no one understands you. You won't get anything out of the sermons. This season happens to all of us and we need to be prepared for it. So let's talk about this. What are the causes? David gives us some, and I like that. But let me point out the two causes that every Christian immediately thinks is the cause. Sinning and not pursuing God. Can this cause this spiritual thirst that I'm describing? Absolutely it can. Is it the primary cause? Absolutely not. But let's talk about them real quick. Obviously, if you're not pursuing God, you're not going to find him. That's no-brainer, right? If you're in your life and you're like, God feels really distant. I'm like, well, have you been pursuing him? No. That may be why. That may be why he's distant. You know, that's an easy fix, man. Just start pursuing him and he won't feel so distant. Okay, you know, and you just go do it. Or if you're like, man, God feels really distant. Well, what's going on in your life? Well, you know, I'm viewing a ton of porn and I'm getting drunk every night and, you know, I'm smoking a lot of crack. I'd be like, you know, that sounds like an issue. You know, that could be one of the reasons why God's feeling kind of distant from you. In Isaiah, God tells his people, he says, my arm is not shortened, nor is my power withered. He says, but your sins have separated you from me. One of the ways that God disciplines us in our sinning is he begins to remove himself from us. And that makes sense. Because if God were to give me intense amounts of intimacy while I was blatantly sinning against him, what he actually would be doing is he would be affirming my sin. He'd be saying, keep on keeping on, man. That's great that you're sinning in that way. God must separate himself from sin to show the fact that he is not pleased with our sin. So absolutely, those could be causes. And I would say that another example would be when it comes to sinning, something that absolutely will separate you from God is pride. And what I mean by that is if I realize that there's sin inside of my life and I say, you know what? I'm going to hunker down and I'm going to conquer this sin. If you yourself are the source of your victory, then what's actually conquering your sin is your pride. And let me give you an example of how that would look. What if I gave you guys a sermon that was like, man, viewing pornography is wrong. And you know what you guys should do? You guys should stop. If you're doing it right now, just stop it. Because it's wrong. And you're better than that. And you listen to that sermon, you're like, yeah, you know what? I am better than that. That is gross. I'm never going to do that again. What did I just appeal to? Your pride. Your flesh. Your selfishness. Does that make sense? So you could conquer your sin, but if you conquer your sin and you are doing it with pride, you're going to end up further away from God than you were in the beginning. Great example, and I'm going to tell this story for two reasons, is the prodigal son. In the story of the prodigal son, you have a father who represents God, and he has two sons. He has two children. A lot of people forget that. They just think he has the one son, the prodigal son. But he actually has two sons. One son chooses to disobey the father by going after fleshliness, after blatant sins, alcohol, prostitutes, that kind of thing. The other son is the proud son. And guess what? Neither son has fellowship with the father. The proud son never leaves the farm, but he spends his entire time sulking in the barn house about how unfair his life is. See, whether your sin is pride or whether your sin is licentiousness, both will separate you from the presence of God. The second reason why I wanted to tell that story is because none of us are perfect. So the idea that my sin is causing separation from God is this. If you are committing blatant sins that you know are wrong and you're not fighting your sin, yes, your sin will separate you from God. However, when the prodigal son returns to the father, he immediately has a reestablished intimacy with the father. You guys understand that? Now, was he completely free from his sin in that moment? No, he's still the same selfish dude that left in the first place. In fact, the entire reason why he came back to the father was because he was hungry. Right? So he's still the same selfish guy. But the fact that he was willing to have a new relationship with the father immediately led to reconciliation. So the important thing about that is this. If I don't understand that, whenever this period of spiritual thirst happens in my life, I will always assume it's because I have sin in my life. And I'll start looking at my life and be like, what sins are in my life? And if you look at your life hard enough, you'll find sin. We all have sin. But if you assume that that is the reason why God is not near to me, then you're going to become a legalist. You're going to become a legalistic Christian. And it pains me when Christians are so simplistic like that. When someone's like, man, I don't feel God. And the immediate response is there sin in your life? That must be the answer. Must be what's going on. Is that what's going on with David? Is he sinning? No, this is happening right after he got his life back on track, when he's pursuing God. And this happened to him. There were certainly consequences of what he did, but they were not a result of him immediately sinning against God. So no, I would say the vast majority of time when you go through a season like this, it is not because of sin. It is not because of something blatant like that. Now, like I said, if it is something blatant like that, that's very easy to spot. If you are in rebellion against God, you know it. You know that you're doing something against God. You know you're serving another master other than Jesus. You know it. If you're not pursuing God, you know it. But if you don't feel close to God and those things aren't immediately apparent to you, that's probably because that's not the problem. There's deeper things happening in your life. And you need to be wise. You need to understand that that is the purpose of it. And let me go over those real quickly in David's life. Now in verse 2, he kind of mentions it. He mentions something interesting. He says, "So I have looked for you in the sanctuary," past tense, "to see your power and your glory." What this means is that David is in a season of his life where he's no longer going to the sanctuary. He's no longer going to services. He's no longer going to the temple. Now, is David doing that because he doesn't want to pursue God? No, he's doing that because he got kicked out of his own kingdom, right? He doesn't have a choice in the matter. Once again, that's not the reason why he's not finding God. In fact, when David was a shepherd and a soldier, we have some of the most beautiful psalms ever written by him before he ever went to the temple, when he was out in the wilderness hanging out with sheep and stuff like that. Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." Right? That was written when he was in the wilderness. That wasn't written when he was in the temple, when he was going to church every Sunday and, you know, reading his Torah or whatever. That happened when he was just out in the wilderness watching sheep. He had intense amounts of intimacy with God. Because here's the deal. If you pursue God, God will meet you where you're at with the capabilities that you have. When I was overseas, I didn't have church. I was in Afghanistan. I could have gone to a mosque, I guess, but it wouldn't have helped me. You know, like that's all I had. I didn't have a church. I didn't have a fellowship. I had no Christians around me. I didn't have any sermons. I didn't have any worship music. You know what I had? I had a little tiny pocket Bible with the New Testament and the Psalms in it. And I read that. That's what I read. I had this little, I still have it to this day. It's all sweaty and crap. But, you know, I still have it, you know? And that was all I had when I was over there. And I had amazing times of intimacy with God. Because God meets you where you're at. If you're in a situation in your life where you're too busy, where you have a work schedule that won't allow you to go to church, or you have a work schedule that won't allow you to get into the Word as much as you want, God meets you where you're at. As long as you are willing to pursue Him, God will meet you. But if you're willing to pursue God, that means you will make a way. You will make a way. You will find time to pursue Him. So that's not the issue, right? That's not the issue that David is going through right now. Now, he kind of alludes to a little bit of bitterness in his life as well in verse 9. I'm not going to go over it right now, but he kind of alludes to a little bit of bitterness in his life. But that, again, that is not the main issue. That's not the reasoning he gives for why he's in the state that he's in. Another problem that I can fall into as a Christian, if I believe that those two issues are the issue that's causing a separation between me and God, is I'm going to get into spiritual emotionalism. And this is what that is. It's where I start equating my relationship with God with my emotions. So if I feel close to God, I assume I am close to God. And when I feel distant from God, I assume I am distant from God. Spiritual emotionalism plagues so many Christians, where all they're pursuing is that a next emotional high from God. So they diligently pursue it. They're praying for it, and they're fasting, and they're going to church, and they're singing worship songs at the top of their lungs, and they're trying to manufacture a type of emotionalism with God. And that is also a trap that you can fall into if you think feeling distant from God is a sign that you are in sin or that you're doing something wrong, which it's not. Not always. Sometimes it is, like I said, but most of the time it is not what this is about. Okay, so what is the cause? If it's not those things, what is the cause? Well, David is going through a couple of these things that is causing it, I believe. And then there's a main cause underlying all of them. I'll give you two. The first one, there are biological reasons of why David is experiencing a distance from God. Like it or not, the way that God created humanity is it says He formed us from the earth, and then He breathed into us, and we became a living soul. You know what that means? That means that unlike what Hindus say, you are body and soul. There is no separation. Does that make sense? That means your body can affect your spiritual state. If you don't believe that, I guess you haven't gone through any type of physical trauma before. When, you like to believe that, you know, no matter what, you could spend time with God. There were times where I was, you know, in the field or something like that, and it's below zero, and I'm shivering and stuff like that, and I'm trying to think about God, and you just can't. You're so cold, or you're so in pain, or you're so, that you just can't think about God. You can't pray. You can't communicate with Him. It's hard. Right? David's in the desert, and he's not in his prime, by the way. He's a little older. He's in the desert. He's running away from his son. He's tired. He's thirsty. He's hungry physically. It's hard to communicate with God when you're in those times. One challenge that I would have for you guys, if once again you're still like, I don't know about that. How many of you guys have tried to fast before? Right, you try to fast? It's good practice. I encourage you guys, if you've never done it, you should try it, man. It's a great way to just, you know, forsake food and just pursue God and just think about Him. But here's the thing. When you're fasting, you think like, man, I'm doing this great spiritual thing. So I bet my prayers are going to be awesome. You know, and I bet when I read the Bible, it's going to pop off the page because I'm fasting, dude. I'm doing this really holy thing. But anyone who's fasted, you know that when low blood sugar hits you, it affects your spirit. It's hard to pray, man. Like, it's hard to focus. You're just like, all you're thinking about is, I want food. You know, like, that's all that's going through your brain. You're like, no, God is good. You know, but really all you're thinking about is, I want food. And you're tired, and it affects you. It impacts you. And to think that your biology does not affect your spiritual life is, once again, it is foolish. It's not true. It absolutely does. So one of the reasons why David is going through what he's going through is because there's biological reasons. He's out in the wilderness. He's pursuing God. And one of the things I want to point out about this psalm that's interesting that most people miss is how short it is. Why is it so short? A lot of people, here David's going through this intense things. He writes some long psalms most of the time when he's going through intense emotional situations. This psalm, 11 verses. You want to know why? Because when you're going through intense things like what David's going through and your biology is kicking against the goads, it's hard to have hour-long prayer sessions with God. And some of the best ways to pursue God is in more is less, right? Less is more, sorry. Where you're just like, if you can't focus on God, if your biology is kicking against goads and you aren't able to focus on God, limit yourself. You're like, dude, I'm just going to pray for like a minute. I'm just going to read like just a little bit of the Bible. Because here's the deal. God would much rather have 1 minute of undivided attention from you than 2 hours of you spacing out. Does that make sense? God is not interested in lip service. He's interested in heart. He would much rather you have just 1 minute of quality time with him than have 2 hours where you're distant and spacey and you're not paying attention to him. So that's one thing to point out. There's probably biological reasons as to why David is feeling emotionally distant from God. There's also probably emotional reasons. If you remember, David is going through a time of intense grief. Intense grief. His own son has raped his own daughter. And then another one of his sons has murdered another one of his sons and risen up against him and is trying to actively kill him. If that doesn't cause grief and depression in your life, I really don't know what would. That would be the most horrific possible thing to go through as a father. To have your own child trying to kill you. That'd be horrible. Beyond that, this civil war that was caused by Absalom, some of David's closest friends sided with Absalom. David lost his family and his closest friends in this battle, in this war. He is going through intense emotional grief at this point. Like I said, your biology is linked to your spirituality. If you're going through emotional angst, I struggle with depression. And when I'm going through bouts of depression, which are basically caused, for me, my depression is it's a biological thing, right? A lot of times I get depressed for no reason. There's nothing going on in my life that's causing it. But that emotional reaction that I have directly affects my relationship with God. When I'm going through depressed seasons, it is hard for me to communicate with God. It is hard for me to get in His Word. Absolutely. He does feel distant from me when I'm depressed. And beyond that, if you want to compound issues, when I'm depressed, I immediately assume the worst. So when God feels distant from me, I always assume I must have sin in my life. And I must be failing, and I must be doing this, and I must be doing that wrong. Right? Which is, again, not necessarily true. There could be emotional reasons as to why you are going through what you're going through. So those two big categories obviously encompass a lot of things. But those are the two major reasons why you and I would go through a time of distance between God. Then there's a third underlying reason that encompasses all of them, and there could be spiritual reasons of why God would take you through a situation like this. Why? God will allow seasons like this to happen in our lives to do two things. Number one, He wants to train our faith. He wants to train our faith. Faith in the Bible is the most precious thing that God sees. It says in Hebrews 11, it says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. When you read 1 Peter 1, he likens faith to being something as precious as gold in the eyes of God. In 1 Peter 3, he likens faith to being an attractive quality that God looks for in a person. And the metaphor that he uses is, he says, it's just like when a husband sees attractive qualities in his wife and he's attracted to her. He says faith is the only thing that attracts God to us. In Psalm 45, the writer of that psalm goes as far to say that God looks at faith as a type of beauty, that he sees it as being beautiful in your life. Faith is by far the most important thing to God that there is. And guess what? Faith must be trained. See, a lot of us, when we think about faith, we just think that, like, I believe that God exists. That's not really what the fullness of faith is. When Jesus talked about faith, he says, believe in me. That's what he said. And believing in a fact is a lot different than believing in a person. Believing in a fact just means that I accept the fact. Believing in a person requires trusting another human being. Right? If I say believe in me, what I'm actually telling you guys to do is I'm telling you guys to trust me. To trust that I'm going to do right. Right? To trust that I'm going to fulfill what I promised to fulfill. When Jesus says to trust in me, what he's saying is you need to have faith, you need to believe that what I said I'm going to do, I'm going to accomplish. That I'm going to be with you. That I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. That I'm with you always, forever, until the end of the ages. That is what it means to believe in Jesus. That I really trust that he's with me always and that he has what's best planned for my life. That when he says I'm forgiven, I'm actually forgiven. When he says I'm made new, I'm made new. When he says I'm a new creation, I'm a new creation. When he says I have a new identity in Christ, I believe I have a new identity in Christ. To so esteem and adore God that he is first in my life. That's what it means to have faith in him. The only way to grow faith in a person is for them to demonstrate faithfulness towards you. Does that make sense? You cannot gain faith towards a person unless they show themselves to be faithful first. God will allow you to go through times like this so that you learn to trust him even when your emotions say otherwise. You learn to believe in what he says even though your emotions are saying, that's not true, that's a lie, that's false. And you learn to silence your emotions and believe in what God says above what your emotions say. That is a very important thing for Christians to do because, like I said, when I put it that way, that God takes us through the seasons like this to make us stronger, to make us better. That means that not only is this not a sign that you're failing, this could actually be a sign that you're doing good and God wants you to do better. Going through a season like this might be absolute proof that you're doing good and God wants you to do better. In fact, Jesus went through a season exactly like this. You know what happened in his life right before he went through a season like this? He was baptized. The Spirit descended on him like a dove, and God parted the heavens and spoke to him. I've had a lot of spiritual experiences in my life. I've had nothing like that. There's never been a time in my life where I saw the Holy Spirit descend like a dove on me, and God parted the heavens and said, "You're awesome." You know, that has just never happened to me. It happened to Jesus. And it says, immediately after that, the Spirit brought him into the wilderness so he could be tempted by Satan for 40 days. Immediately. Was that a sign that Jesus had done something wrong? No. It was a sign that he had done something right and his Father was calling him into deeper intimacy with him. Going into a season like this might be absolute proof that you're doing correct things in your life and you need to understand that. Another reason is it helps us to seek him for the sake of seeking him and not for any selfish reasons. See, if every single time I pursued God and reached out to God, he gave me an emotional reaction, what would end up happening is I would stop pursuing God and I would start pursuing the emotional blessing that God gives me. To put it another way, I would stop pursuing God and I would start pursuing an idol, which is myself. God himself is glorious and he himself is worthy of being sought after, whether you have an emotional, spiritual experience with him or not. He is worth pursuing even if you are going through a wilderness experience like David. He is worth giving everything up for him. And unless you go through a season like this, you'll never learn to pursue God for the sake of pursuing God. You will always pursue God to receive a blessing. See, God is the blessing. He is the treasure. That's why when David's praying this prayer, if you notice, when he ends the prayer, he's still thirsting for God. God doesn't answer his prayer. He never says, and then God answered me, and I was filled with the Spirit, and my problems went away. No, he says, he ends the prayer, he just ends the prayer. He ends the prayer on a line of hope. He says, I know that things are going to work out for me, but they hadn't. And what this shows is that David was exercising extreme faith, trust, and love for God. That he's saying, God, even though everything in my life is falling apart, you are still worthy. You are still good. And I will always pursue you. I will always praise you no matter what. That is the underlying reason of why God brings us through seasons like this. Sometimes that's the only reason. Sometimes there is no biological or emotional reason why you go through a season like this. Sometimes that you're just going to go through it. Other times the biological and emotional reasons are going to be why you're going through it. But ultimately, God is trying to train your faith and train your trust in Him. And the best example we have for that is in a human relationship. You see, if you're in a human relationship, you're in a romantic relationship with someone, why do you want to be pursued by that person? I mean, if every single time my wife started pursuing me, I gave her a treat, I would start kind of wondering, like, I wonder if she likes me or the treat. You know, like if every single time she reached out, she's like, Peter, I love you. I'm like, let's go to dinner, you know, and I brought her to a nice dinner. Eventually, I would start thinking, I think she doesn't love me. I think she likes the dinner. You know, I think that she just like, you see, in a relationship, you want that person to pursue you just because they love you. They want you, regardless if they get something out of it or not. That's when you know that person really genuinely cares about me, that they're willing to go out of their way for me, that they're willing to even suffer for me just so they could get closer to me. That it's just about me. It's not about any reward. It's not about any external reward. It's just about me. It's about the relationship. See, God's no different. That's what He wants. He wants you to pursue Him because He is good, not because you want something good from Him. And that brings us out of our selfishness, and it brings us to a place where we can finally glorify God. Now, we know this in our head, and understanding this in our heart is a process. Going through a season like this, I'll tell you guys, from going through many, many seasons like this in my life, I'll tell you, they're not over quickly. They're not over quickly. I think the shortest one I've ever gone through has been like a month and a half. It's not like, it's like, you know, you go through it for a little bit and you're like, I know God's trying to chain me and trying to move me closer to Him, so I'm just going to pursue Him. And the next day it just, oh, you know, it just goes away and you find an intimacy with God. It's usually, for me, it usually lasts around 2 to 3 months where I do not feel God, where He feels distant. It's a long time. And the question is, how do I practically wait on the Lord? How do I practically wait for God to do this miracle in me, to bring me into a deeper level of intimacy with me? How do I do that? Because the result of this will be that you will have a deeper level of intimacy with God than you've ever had before. And that's true for any human relationship too. I love the seasons of my life with my wife where everything was going great and we were having just a good time, right? I always look back on the times we went to Disney World and stuff, and I'm like, those were awesome. But you know what? We didn't grow as a couple in those times. See, those times were just, they were just a fruit of the goodness that we had already sowed into the relationship. Nothing new came out of that. You know the times where we really grew and developed as a couple? It's through fire. It was through arguments. It was through fights. It was through misunderstandings. It was through trials. It was through anxiety and stress and all these other things that come along with a relationship. Those are the times that we pressed into each other and we really, really learned how to love one another just for the sake of loving one another. It will produce a deeper level of intimacy than you've ever known. But how do you wait for that blessing? How do you not give up? How do you not throw in the towel and lose heart, which is the easiest thing to do in a season like this? How do you do that? Well, David gives us some hints right here. This is what he's practically doing to make sure he doesn't do that. Verse 2. So I've looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips shall praise you. Number one, David thought back to times of intimacy with God. David began to meditate on, to think about, actively pursue in his mind the times where God had been near to him. And he started thinking about those times. He started thinking like, man, if God is that good, I know how good God is. Right? I don't want to leave him for some other lesser thing. I know how good he is. I don't want to throw in the towel. God, help me to continue to pursue you and remind me of the times where you were near to me, that I don't lose heart. Right? But I think about those times, and that gives me confidence for the future. He not only remembers times of intimacy with God, but he remembers who he is in God. Notice what he says, your loving kindness is better than life. He remembers what's going on in his life. His own son has turned against him. Do you think that impacted the way he felt about himself? I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever gone through a season in your life where everything in your life is falling apart and the only person you could blame is yourself. That's what David's going through. Where he's like, my life is falling apart and it's because I've been a crap father. That's why this is happening to me. He feels worthless. He feels destroyed. He feels horrible about who he is. And you know what he thinks about? I know that God loves me as I am. Your loving kindness is better than life. I know you care about me. Even though my emotions don't feel it or sense it in any way, I know you care about me. And I know you cherish me. And he reminds himself of that truth. The next thing that he does is in verse 6 through 7. When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. Because you have been my help, therefore, in the shadow of your wings, I will rejoice. Verse 7 describes not only does he think about past intimacy with God, and not only does he think about the love of God, but he thinks about the past deliverances of God. Let me read verse 7 again. Because you have been my help. He practically thinks about the times where God has delivered him. The times where God has been there for him and has delivered and has helped him out. And he meditates on those things, those times. The word meditate is kind of gross, actually. It's a Hebrew word that they use to describe the way cows ate, which is nasty, right? Cows, when they eat, they have multiple stomachs. So they eat, and then when they swallow it, they allow it to digest in one stomach, and then they vomit it up in their mouth, and then they eat it again, and then they swallow it back down, and they go into the second stomach. It's kind of nasty, but that's what the word meditate means. So what it's talking about is it's saying, when he's saying meditate, he's saying, I'm continually running it through my mind as often as I can. Because in times like this, in times of emotional distance from God, it's so easy to meditate on the negatives of your life. It's so easy to meditate on what's going wrong in your life and how it's terrible. And David could have easily said that. He could have said, like, dude, every day I just meditate on how bad of a dad I am and how much my life sucks at this point. But instead he says, man, I meditate. I actively train my mind to think about your faithfulness in the past so that I do not slip into depression. That's what he's talking about. He's saying, I actively meditate on the goodness of God in the past, even though I don't feel it, so that I do not slip into grief and into cynicality, which is our tendency. This remembering of the past gives him a practical hope for the future. Verse 5. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. Notice he says shall, meaning it hasn't happened. He is not filled. He is not satisfied with God at the point he's writing this. He is not currently joyfully praising God at the time that he's writing this. But because of the past faithfulness of God, David has hope for the future, that he knows God will deliver me. Don't fall into the trap where you think this is going to be my lot in life. This is just how it is. You know, Jesus just wants me to follow him no matter what. And that means my life's going to suck, but that's okay because he's God and I just have to do it. That's cynicality. That's negativity, thinking that you're never going to get out of this season. You will get out of this season because if God's been faithful in the past, he will be. He absolutely will be faithful in the future, and you could trust in that. Verse 10 through 11 also helps us with that. I'm actually going to start in verse 9, actually. I'm sorry. Those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals, but the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him shall glory, but the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. Two things that he uses in this future hoping to quell current situations in his heart. Number one, like I said, he is struggling with bitterness. Even though Absalom is his son, his actions are so horrendous that, yes, David is struggling with not loving his son. He is struggling with hating his son and hating those people that betrayed him. He absolutely is. And the only thing that helps him to not slip into that bitterness is trusting in the future judgment of God. Saying, God, you are going to judge him. You're going to judge the people in this way and that went against me. And I believe that. I don't want to give in to bitterness to quell the thirst in my heart. I want to trust you. And that's what he's praying. He's praying that he would trust in God, that he would hope in the justice of God. The second thing that he's praying for when he says, but the king shall rejoice in God, everyone who swears by him shall glory, let the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. Like I said, there's no time in David's life, we know, if you actually read this story in 2 Samuel, there's no time in David's life where he most doubted who he was in God. It was so bad that there was a point in time where he was walking down the street and some random dude shows up and starts hurling rocks at his head and telling David what a loser he was. And one of David's mighty men is like, dude, let me kill that guy. And David says, no, I think God sent him. I think God sent him. He's telling the truth. I am a loser. You know, that I deserve this. There was no point in David's life where he most doubted the love for God, that love that God had for him, and his own identity as a person, his own worth, his own value. There was never a time in David's life that he doubted more than this season of his life. And when he says, the king shall rejoice, he calls himself the king, shall rejoice in God. What he's doing is he is not listening to the way his emotions are going. He's not saying, yes, I'm worthless, yes, I'm terrible. He's remembering what God has called him to be. God has called me king, therefore I'm the king. Not because I want to be, not because I deserve to be, but because that's what God has called me to be. We do the same things in our life. We remember, I am a child of God. I am a son of the living God, not because I want to be, right? Not because I worked for it, but because God has called me to be that. And that is who I am. To remind ourselves of the truth of what God has done gives us hope for the future. Hope is the number one thing that Satan wants to snuff out in your life. But Hebrews 6 says, this hope we have is an anchor for our soul, both sure and steadfast. It pierces through to the other side of the veil. Right? This is what God is trying to build inside of our lives, a supreme hope in him that we don't lose heart at the circumstances in our life. The final thing that I'm going to mention that he does is he doesn't grow weary in doing good. This is verse 3 through 4. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. What he's saying the idea of blessing and praising God is he's saying, I will continue to say how good you are, even though I don't feel it. I'm going to continue to tell you how good you are. I'm going to continue to bless you. I'm going to continue to praise you. And the word bless, by the way, when it's being used to describe, you know, blessing someone as a verb in the Hebrew, it literally means to get on your knees before someone and praise them. That's what it means. He's saying, I'm going to continue to do these things, even though I don't feel like it. When I say don't grow weary while doing good, this is what I mean by that. Don't stop doing the things you know are right just because you don't feel God. Don't say, well, I don't feel God, so what's the point of me praying to him? And what's the point of me worshiping him? What's the point of me reading in his word? The point is that once again, you're learning how to not be selfish and pursue God for his glory and not for your benefit. Every single relationship goes through a season like this where you don't feel relatively close to that person, even though you are. Every relationship goes through this. Now imagine if I went through a season like this with my wife where I just felt distant from her, where we felt out of sync. And I sat down with her, I was like, you know what, Emma, I want to pursue you because that's the right thing to do because we're married and I love you. I want to pursue you, so let's hang out, let's spend time together. And then we went out to dinner and we spent time together and we hung out, but I'm still in my funk. And after it was over, she was like, hey, that was fun. And I was like, it wasn't fun for me. I'm never doing that again. That was a waste. You know, like, and then I just end it with her. I mean, that would tear. That would be horrible, right? Why? Because it's not about what I get out of it. It's about the fact that that's the right thing to do. We continue to spend time with God and we continue to pursue Him, not because you get anything out of it, but because that's the correct thing to do. Because you love Him. That's why you do it. He is worthy of being pursued whether you feel like it or not. The other thing that He mentions is He says in verse 4, He says, I will lift up my hands in your name. So, the lifting up of hands, it's an interesting thing. I mean, we do it in church, right? You know, people lift up their hands when they worship God. And that's cool. I mean, that's definitely something that He is talking about. There was if you ever see Middle Eastern people, not just Jews, any Middle Eastern people, they're very, I don't know what the word is, they gesture a lot. They use their hands a lot. They talk with their hands. They're very emotional people, right? And so, you know, when they're praising God, you better believe they're praising God. If you ever want to see how emotional Jews can get, Google Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And you'll see Jews, these hardcore Jews, who are going before the wall that used to be the temple, and they will be bawling their eyes out. And they will be hitting their heads against it. And you're like, whoa, that's intense, you know? I mean, they're acting like it just fell down, even though it happened 2,000 years ago. They're intensely emotional people. So yeah, there's this idea that is an act of praise towards God. But it's more than that. It's a lot more than that. In the Psalms, there's a repeated phrase where they say, we lift up holy hands to God. And what that refers to is it refers to before they went to the temple, they used to baptize their hands. They used to immerse their hands in water. Before they did any of the feasts, before they did anything. And what baptism signified for the Jew was it signified taking something that is secular and making it holy. Does that make sense? So what you're saying is these hands were just used to, you know, work on my house or, you know, clean up after my dog or, you know, whatever. My hands were just used for that stuff that's not holy, that's not godly. And now I'm washing them in water and reminding myself these hands are now for God's use. Everything I do with these hands is for God's purposes. So when He's saying, I lift up my hands to you, that's what He's saying. He's saying, everything I do, everything my hands touch, God, they're holy. They're dedicated to you and to your service. And what it's signifying is David is not going to stop doing good works. He's not going to say, well, you know, I'm in a funk, so, you know, I'm going to stop doing good things that I know God wants me to do. I'm going to stop fighting sin. There's just so much stuff going on in my life. I can't focus on that right now. He's like, no, I'm going to continue because that's what I need to do. I need to deepen my relationship with God. So I'm going to continue to do the things that I know are right, regardless of whether I feel something or not. So don't grow weary while doing good. The final thing that I'll say before we end is this. David was able to get out of his funk. If you read the rest of his life, he was able to get out of his funk. It was a tough thing, for sure, but he was able to do it. And he was able to do it with the faithfulness that God had in his life. And this is the point that I'm going to make to us. The resources that you and I have are infinitely greater than anything David had. David wasn't aware of the gospel. David was not aware of the gospel. He never saw the gospel happen, right? When we're talking about thinking of God's past faithfulness, when we're talking about hoping in the future and stuff like that, David was not able to look back at a time where he's like, I am so confident that God loves me because God literally was crucified on my behalf. See, he wasn't able to write something like the Apostle Paul did in Romans 8, where he says that since God did not spare his only son, but gave him up for us freely, we know that how will he not freely give us all things along with him? Paul had so much confidence that God was going to be faithful because he was not even willing to spare his only begotten son. But he crucified him for our sake. Right? That's something infinitely greater than anything David could have looked back on. And what about the future? When we read in the Old Testament, I mean, the people in the Old Testament, they had a relationship with God, but you don't really see too much hope that they're going to be with God forever. You see vague things, like in Psalm 23, where he says, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You see very vague things, but you also see a lot of Psalms where he says, I will go down to the dust and I will never praise you again. Why? In the Old Testament, before the crucifixion of Jesus, The Old Testament saints did not go to heaven because there was no covering for sin. They only had the animal sacrifices. After Jesus' crucifixion, Jesus descended into where they were and he brought them up into heaven. But before then, they couldn't go to heaven. Which means that David's hope of what was going on in his life, it was a hope that was so vague, it was so foggy, he didn't even know what he was hoping for. Our resources are so much greater than what David had. We could say something like what the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, where he says, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. He said that with absolute confidence. We have far more resources than anyone in the Old Testament could have ever dreamed to have. So that means if David was able to get out of what he was going through with the meek resources that he had, you have infinitely more capability to get out of what you're going through because of what Jesus has done. Meditate on the cross and learn to love its message. And you will learn how to go through any situation in your life that plagues you, especially this type of spiritual depression. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word and what it does for us. I pray that we would be Christians that would meditate on your word, that we would be Christians that would understand what you have done for us, God. That we would learn from what David has written, and that we would learn not to grow weary in seasons where you feel distant, but we would learn to pursue you no matter what. And in your name.